stomach problems. This one happens after the funeral, after the burial, back at the house. Back at the house where the family and friends and the loved ones of the deceased are having some food and drink and enjoying some warm reminiscences of the person who passed away. Sooner or later, someone is bound to say the following, especially after a few drinks. You know, I think he's up there now, smiling down at us. And I think he's pleased. Now, first of all, there is no up there. For people to be smiling down from. It's poetic, it's quaint, and I guess for superstitious people it provides a little comfort, but it doesn't exist. But if it did, and if someone did somehow survive death in a non-physical form, I personally think he'd be far too busy with other celestial activities than to be standing around paradise, smiling down. On live people. What kind of a fucking eternity is that? And why is it no one ever says, I think he's down there now, smiling up at us? Apparently, it never occurs to people that their loved ones might be in hell. Your parents could be in hell right now. Your parents in hell. Your father, for sure. Oh, shit. Hell is full of dads. Full of dads. Even the ones who took you to the ball game. Just for beating the shit out of you once too often. And fucking the neighbor lady. And fucking the neighbor dog. And who knows, maybe even fucking the UPS man. We'll never know what mischief Dad was up to. Parents in hell. Kind of gives you a nice feeling, doesn't it? It does me. Grandparents in hell. Picture that. Picture your grandmother in hell. Baking pies without an oven. And if someone were in hell, I doubt very seriously he'd be smiling. I think he's down there now, screaming up at us. And I think he's in severe pain. People just refuse to be realistic.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance. Terrible Tommy right here in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana. Nice day today. It's getting up in the 40s. Somebody says it's going to get up around 50 today. Man, I'm getting my thong out and getting my rubber boat and going down to the creek. Yeah, it's December the 15th, 2014, and Moon's Day. And we got a half a moon. I always look over here at my Frank Silva Memorial clock and see what that moon's doing. And we're coming up on winter solstice, right? Meaning that the sun or the earth will be tilted away from the sun at its extreme. And then it'll start moving back. Earth will start tilting back towards the sun. And that's when the sun starts getting warmer and brighter. And you get warmer if you're in a cold part of the world. In other words, the rebirth of the sun. And, of course, that's where this practical science becomes mythical science. Not mythical science, but mythical legends and so forth about how the ancients used to think that the sun, once it got all the way, according to them, the farthest away from him, then it came back through a cave in the earth, a tunnel through the earth. And So they developed some pretty bizarre legends about the sun. But the most bizarre legend is Christmas and Christ and Jesus, because it's all based on the sun story, the sun truth. All astrological, and that's what it is. Well, I think we're either going to have a very busy week here in the bunker or a very slow week, depending on how you look at things, because we're going to be doing some more reading in here. We're going to finish up the Exiles from History, and then we're going to go into the subject that can cause all kinds of consternation and disagreements and everything else. And it's about Hitler as a youth and the many things about him that perhaps you didn't know. I'm rereading this book that I put on back on the shelf 30 years ago. But now I find it to be more important than ever, especially to the younger people. Well, here we go. This is about power, out of Exiles from History by David McCaldon, who is no longer with us. In his strikingly personal book, Jews and American Politics, author Stephen D. Isaac spells out some very pertinent questions right on the dust jacket. He asks, why is the political power of American Jews and their contribution far greater than their numbers? Why do Jews seldom run for office, and why do so many work behind the scenes as strategists? Well, there's a lot more running for office now than there used to be, that's for sure. The book is based on personal interviews with 200 leading American Jews, many of whom initially balked at the thought of letting it all hang out for the goyim to read and react to. This paranoia is well illustrated in a most curious appraisal of the book by Joseph Kraft, a vast storehouse of information on a touchy subject which is poorly understood by Jews and their enemies. Kraft might as well have changed the period comma and added the goyim. To the political Jew, the world is not populated by Jews and non-Jews, it's populated by Jews and their enemies. Isaac provides a multitude of examples, many in direct response to his manuscript. Quote, though well aware of the inbred dread of impending doom, this writer was startled by the responses of noted public men on the subject of anti-Semitism. One question was repeated to those who gave longer interviews for this book. Do you think it could happen here? Never was it necessary to define it. In almost every case, the reply was approximately the same. If you know history at all, you have to presume that it could happen, but that it will. Or it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Fear, undoubtedly, is the greatest single factor accounting for Jews' high level of political activity. In one way or another, Jews in the politics are, at the extreme, striving to avoid becoming lampshades, or at least striving for a just society, which may ultimately be the same thing. Of course, you see how they scare the hell out of the live Jews with stories like that, phony stories like the lampshades, which have been proven as ridiculous. But in every war, the propagandists come up with stories similar to this. Many of those interviewed for the book expressed alarm at the possible uses of such a survey. One man, named in the first chapter of this book, reacted with alarm when he was shown a draft of the chapter. Oh, no, he exclaimed. You can't do that. Please don't do that. He explained that while he felt flattered to be included, identifying him as being Jewish would cause him problems. You just don't understand. It's getting bad out there, he said, pointing his forefinger back over his right shoulder. I pick it up everywhere I go. It's increasing like you wouldn't believe. I really wish you wouldn't do this book at all. Even proper nouns are cause for hysterics. The syndrome operates when most Jews read their morning newspaper as their glance flits across the table. They might overlook the word Jewish in one, not so with the word Jew. The eye rivets to that word as if it's as goose stepped off the page. To a non-Jew, the two words might seem interchangeable, but the short noun form is clipped and harsh, and when used by a non-Jew, is considered usually pejorative in itself, as if in other surroundings it might be followed by, say, bastard. Its use by a non-Jew almost automatically makes him suspect of being an anti-Semite. Jewish radar, which my lady calls Judar, the knot of fear, is a characteristic of many of the Jews in politics. At least while they are there, they can work to keep the system free from the terrors that almost all other systems before have meant for the Jews. But along with this, the political Jews have, in the main, tried very hard to seem un-Jewish, as if to make themselves acceptable in the other white Anglo-Saxon Protestant world. Such a reaction to correct nouns would be cause for psychiatric treatment if it occurred in any other ethnic group. If the British suddenly went into apoplectic fits every time they were called Britons or Brits, they would surely be regarded as suffering from a group psychological dysfunction. But perhaps it's because the psychological industry is largely run by Jews that such behavior among Jews is regarded as rational. But Isaacs, who usually works as a journalist for the Washington Post and is therefore highly qualified to comment on power in high places, has highlighted two very important behavior patterns here. The Jewish paranoia simultaneously drives Jews into positions of political power, and at the same time it makes them keep a low profile while they are about it. So we end up with a curious phenomenon of Jews scrambling to keep a tight control over the reins of power, while at the same time pretending to the rest of the world that they are doing nothing of the sort. Who, us? Nah, as Isaacs points out. Thus, until recently, very recently, many Jews were pleased if someone told them that they didn't look very Jewish. If they did look Jewish, they hastened to correct it with a nose job or a hydrogen peroxide. Even in an event in the industry permeated by Jews, as was and is the film industry, the Jewish movie stars enjoyed prominence not under their richly European Jewish names, but as WASPs. So one got the celluloid version of Isher Danielovich as Kirk Douglas, and Bernie Schwartz as Tony Curtis, and Emanuel Goldenberg as Edward G. Robinson, and Daniel Kaminsky as Danny Kay, and so on. Out in the real world, Steins became Stones, Goldbergs became Golds, and David Davidovich became Davises. Isaacs might also have pointed out that the Jewish producers aid and abet in the masking of Jewish characteristics in Hollywood. For some curious reason, Jewish characteristics are often played by goys and righteous Gentile roles are played by Jews. At the time of the writing, a patrician Swedish actress, Ingrid Bergman, has just been cast as Golda Meir, and the British Jew Michael Caine has just appeared on television as a German officer in a World War II movie, The Eagle Has Landed. Could it be that the producers are trying to confuse their audiences' concepts of what a Jew looks like? Or are they acting out some psychological drive that tells them This is what the Jews should look like. Do Jews have such a low opinion of their physical image that they continually seek to upgrade it through celluloid flights of fancy? We will return to this poignant question later. Isaacs opens up his fascinating little book with a detailed description of a 1970 fundraiser for Senator George McGovern. The private Manhattan hotel suite was rented by a group of politically astute Jewish businessmen who were planning on financial support supporting McGovern, since he was the far-left Democrat and the right up their street. Everything went smoothly with McGovern giving all the right answers until the $65,000 question. Senator, just what is your position on Israel? With all the sophistication and urbane cosmopolitanism with such a South Dakota anoints its favorite sons, McGovern answered that the United Nations should work out peace arrangements between the Israelis and the Palestinians. McGovern was obviously laboring under the illusion that the same rules which apply to the rest of the world are also to apply to Israel, where U.S. intervention anyplace else is bad, a bad thing. The U.S. military intervention and support of Israel is a good thing, whereas the United Nations was a good thing when it voted to establish the Israel identity in November of 47. It became a bad thing, when it supported the rights of Palestinians. A heated exchange took place between the assembled Jewish philanthropists and the shy, gentle plainsmen. It ended with one of the Jews reprimanding McGovern like a naughty schoolboy who had not done his homework. Let me ask you a question, Senator. What did you expect this group to ask you? Why are you so poorly prepared on a question of this importance? Isaac sets the tone for his insightful book with this wonderful vignette of Jewish browbeating and string pulling. Americans have to thank such political action groups for the humiliating defeat of an honest, if absurdly naive, McGovern, and the landslide victory of the criminal and hypocritical Richard Nixon. The author provides a list after list of prominent Jewish advisors, campaign managers, power brokers, financiers, opinion makers, lawyers, staff aides, and writers. He disarmingly points out that although the many fields Jews are not overrepresented, their positions of importance ensure that they do not need to be. He cites Capitol Hill as being one place where the effectiveness of the Jewish staffers more than outweighs their numeric weakness. And although Jews do not own most of the newspapers or TV stations in America, well, I think you're wrong there. Majority of the big papers have been owned in the past by the Jews. Newspapers or TV stations in America, their ownership of the major city newspapers and of TV networks ensures the smaller but more numerous Gentile media have to toe the line. Yeah, there he goes. He states that at one time the Jewish-owned newspapers like the New York Times would even avoid hiring too many Jews for fear of this ploy seeming too obvious. Yeah, but the stranglehold grip of the Jews over the media means that nowadays they can staff the entire building with Jews from editor to doorman, and no one in the rest of America would be the wiser. With the greater visual impact of television, it is a different story, says Isaac. Although the networks are owned and run by Jews, they still insist on having a WASP as a front man or anchor man on the air. In government, Jews percolate. Now remember, this was printed in 1982. See how fast things have moved forward since then? Now we've got plenty of Jews in the position of anchor men on TV. In government, Jews percolate towards these those departments most suited to their skills. Thus, the federal departments of justice, welfare, finance, labor, science, and health all have large numbers of Jews under their roofs. Isaacs tells us that the vast number of Jews in the Department of Justice is because justice coincides with the oldest of Jewish ethics. In a curious Freudian slip, the author has set us to thinking which Jewish ethic it is that coincides with justice, since it's not justice itself. Perhaps the Jewish concept of justice is it good for the Jews? In another chapter, dealing with the Jewish political donations, Isaacs does indeed spell it out. Quote, most Jews are paying to put into power the kind of men who will neither confiscate Jews' assets, wall them into ghettos, nor annihilate them. The most donations have been, at bottom, motivated by fear of what happened in England, France, Spain, Germany. And Germany, it could and may indeed happen in the United States. Two, unless America's Jews are vigilant and ensure that the right men get into the office. And since the right has many meanings, the money has gone to the wide variety of candidates and causes. These contributors, by far the largest number of Jewish political givers, have tended to talk in code. They say they invest in good government when they are, in fact, paying tribute for survival. Isaacs goes on to show how Jews have traditionally supported liberalism or even socialism because such philosophies favor the Jewish survival. I don't agree. They've moved into capitalism big time. But things start to get awry when liberal policies are taken too far, are practiced universally. Jews fully supported the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s. They supported affirmative action program for blacks. They supported integration of black and white Gentile schools. But when all of this progress started to directly affect the Jews, then they began to have second thoughts. When the affirmative action would become a quota system, then they would surely mean that Jews would be thrown out of or kept out of many jobs, since the Jews are grossly overrepresented in many professions. The expansion of busing program and public housing schemes would now mean that, heaven forbid, Jewish children might be integrated and Jewish neighborhoods might be plagued with black crime. Simultaneously, in the outside world, the extreme left, the third world in the United States, all of whom had previously danced to the Zionist tune, were now turning bitterly anti-Israel. A massive turnaround came about in Jewish thinking, and one-time leftist, even Marxist Jews, almost overnight became neoconservatives. The New York Jewish intelligentsia switched positions so quickly it was almost dizzying. Yet still we are continually told that the Jews have almost a copyright on ethics, righteousness, justice, and honor. In reality, the Jews are concerned only with what is perceived as being good for Jews. Well, I say that basically there's nothing wrong with that. As long as the people that are trying to screw, screw back. And don't let them do what they do, you see. It takes two to tango. One is letting it happen, one is doing it, and one is letting it happen. Terrible Tommy's comment. Whether the candidate belongs to the Elephant Party or the Jackass Party matters not at all. But if that were all there was to it, the phenomenon might be considerably easier to understand. Almost every ethnic group that is conscious of its ethnic identity will vote for candidates who pitch for its own interests. The notable exception to the ethnic rule is, of course, the majority of white Anglo-Saxon group, which has little sense of its own identity, and if it does, suffers from guilt complexes brought about by decades of liberal brainwashing. Many otherwise rational white people will vote for black, Mexican, Jewish candidates on the basis that it's time the minorities had their chance. Non-whites find this practice hilarious and extreme and take fullest advantage of it in their efforts to become top dog. The wrinkles to the Jewish behavior pattern are several. First of all, Jews will vigorously push candidates who represent Jewish interests, while at the same time protesting loudly that there is no such thing as a powerful Jewish lobby and that they are purely interested in humanity or justice or good government. In truth, all they are interested in is Jewish humanity, Jewish justice, and Jewish government. Well, they're not even that interested in Jewish humanity because the last I checked, New York City had 250,000 Jews living under the poverty line. So I think what we're dealing with is some Jews at the top that are using their compadres to amass and keep the power of the few at the top. I think that that's what needs to be always brought out. Most of the time, the person on the street or the working class or the poor are not controlling these things at the top. Anyhow, but secondly, and perhaps most significantly, as Isaacs points out, the chief motivation of Jewish political power is fear. Well, I guess our government now is totally Jewish because that's the only way it maintains power, is through the spreading of fear. The whole Defense Department, which is the War Department, is based on fear. We got to have more planes, more ships, more this, more that, because they're going to get us. So we have been infiltrated with this virus that the Jews carry, and it permeates white society. Even when the Jews are in total control and have never had it so good, such as in the United States today, still there is as much fear of being holocausted as there ever was. This cannot be explained in terms of the empirical evidence. No anti-Semitic policies are part of the platform of any major political party, unfortunately. The Jewish stranglehold over communications means that only Philo-Semitic views are broadcast. Candidates representing various American Nazi parties have never garnered more than a handful of votes. Therefore, the intense fear suffered by Jews must be generated inside themselves. It must be of psychological origin. If we ask why it is that Jews spend a large part of their time acting out their fear of being holocausted, we must conclude that Jews inwardly feel that they deserve to be holocausted. No one has come up to them and announced to them that they ought to be holocausted. They have imagined that this is what is going on. I was thinking about this, too, and what got me to be very much critical and even sometimes in hatred of at least a portion of the Jews was when I was in the John Birch Society, read all these books, and there were a lot of good books the Birch Society had, especially about the system and so forth. But I got to studying more and more about the banking system and international banking, and I kept seeing Jewish names. And so I'd be talking to people, and I'd start saying, gee, I noticed there's a lot of Jewish names up there, and they climb down my throat. People get mad at me. I'm talking about non-Jews. And I said, wait a minute, I'm just talking about what is. There's a lot of Jews at the top running these banks. And the more I did that, the more they climbed my frame, which gradually drove me into being very anti-Jew. In other words, the whole Jewish concept of their fear of everybody actually created somebody they probably should fear. Well, I don't have the power to make them fear much, but you get what I mean. The Jews are projecting their fantasies, their fears, into the rest of us, and that's my big point. Begin to act like everybody's a Jew. Look at Christmas time, which is really a Jewish holiday. I said the other day, I read that article, about all these Christmas songs that were created by Jews, and they had a lame excuse about it. Well, I think it's obvious that that was strictly a weapon, a propaganda weapon, to drive people into this new capitalista holiday of Christmas, which they're not even much giving reverence even to the phony Jesus. No, it's to get people to support the big box stores. And you notice the big box stores came around about the same time in the 20s. I mean, there were big box stores before then, but mainly in New York and places like that. But they became the capitalists, and the capitalist Jews built these giant department stores and played a lot of Christmas music. And that's where the people went to spend money. Money, money, money. It's easy to figure out. It wasn't because they so much loved music, or the people who wrote the songs may have felt that way, but the thinkers and the shakers and rulers of the Jews said, hey, this is what we need to get these dumb goyim into the shopping centers. Why is it so? We will explore this area in greater detail in a later chapter, but for now, let us just note that much Jewish behavior in politics can be explained in terms of self-hate, name-changing, nose jobs. Remember I told you before, I used to get under Irv Rubin's skin, the head of the JDL in L.A., when we debate or whatever it was, and I had found out that Sherry, his wife, had borrowed money from her dad and mom to get a $2,000 nose job. I said, Irv, I thought you were a proud Jew. How come your wife got a nose job to look like a Gentile? And he just used to go nuts at that. Gentile wives' assimilation are all declarations by the Jews that they do not like being Jewish. They hate themselves so much that they wish they were something they are not. The guilt and anxiety inculcated into them by their religion, by their culture, and by their mothers is a guarantee of an end product psyche that is loaded with self-hate and low esteem. Jews wish to be in control of political affairs and everything else of any importance, precisely because they feel that if they themselves hate being Jewish, then it stands to reason that everyone else will hate Jewishness also and will seek to eradicate it. Well, that's certainly true because, I mean, when I was a kid, I think there were maybe a handful of Jews around this county, but I never heard about them. Nobody ever talked about them, and you just think maybe they're Italian, you know, or maybe they're Greek or something like that, of which we did have a couple of Greeks in town that ran a candy kitchen, because you didn't think about Jews. The closest you came to thinking about Jews is a stupid Christian religion when my mom and dad used to drag me at the threat of violence to church and have to listen to all this bullshit. But if Jews are in charge of society, then they will be in the position of quickly knock on the head of any manifestation of this possibility. In other words, they hate themselves, so they create other people, do things to cause other people to hate them, and then if they're in power, they can fight them. What a screwy butt. I'm telling you, it'd be funny if it wasn't so serious. The irony, of course, is that by overcompensating and overreacting in this way, they may very well create the kind of anti-Semitism that they set out to suppress. And that's interesting why they use the word anti-Semitism at all. Semitism, or Semite, that word was coined and created by a German Gentile back in, I believe it was the 1800s. And, of course, they're using it now as to be anti-Jewish, but I always say, well, what about all these Semite Arabs? They're more Semite than you are, than you European Jews. They don't want to talk about that. Nobody wants to talk about that. As more and more citizens become aware of and resentful of Jewish control of American society, then those same citizens may well begin to strenuously seek the overthrow of that control and the restoration of a democratic majority rule. Well, there is no such thing as democratic majority rule. All governments are oligarchies. There are different forms of oligarchies, you know. Every leader has his crew of guys at the top, or women, or whatever. And that's just the way it is. There's only one kind of government, oligarchy. The kings, they had their favorite guys and their guards around them. You know, Mussolini, Hitler, everybody, presidents, they all had their crew. So government's oligarchy. And this has become, the one we live in has become probably the most dangerous oligarchy that there ever was, through converting it a republic into an empire. And once you've gone to empire, you're not going to last too long. You're going to go down the tube some way. Either some other empire puts you down, or you just gradually deteriorate and bankrupt yourself and so forth. Okay, this is a chapter on the Holocaust by David McCollum. Holocausts, we're told, are nothing new to the Jews. They've been suffering regular extermination programs since time began, and in most cases they deserved it. First, the Egyptians and the Persians, then the Romans, then the Spanish, then the Russians, then the Nazis, and today the Arabs. As the candid Jewish historian Dr. Howard F. Stein wrote in the Journal of Historical Review, Winter 1980, quote, "For the Jews, the term Holocaust does not simply denote a single catastrophic era in society, but it is a grim metaphor for the meaning of Jewish history." Excuse me, my coffee is getting cool. Okay. The Holocaust lies in the heart of the Jewish experience of time itself. One is either anxiously awaiting persecution, experiencing persecution, recovering from persecution, or living in a period that is temporary reprieve from persecution. Holocaust is thus the timeless fabric in which the 33 to 45 period is woven. Thus, the reality of the Holocaust is inextricably part of the myth in which it is woven, and for which myth it serves as a further confirmatory evidence for the timeless Jewish theme that the world is in conspiracy to annihilate them, one way or another, at least eventually. And, of course, the question a lot of people have always asked themselves, why the Jews? I mean, you know, we've had different groups that didn't like the Jews, and different groups that kicked their ass and so forth, but every group in the world has had that problem. Of course, Christianity, after being created by the Jews, and their first founding fathers were all Jews, then turned around and vying for power, and every once in a while would go against the Jews. Indeed, the perception of many that these Holocausts is strikingly synchronous. We can trace the same feature in all of them, persecution by anti-Semites, gassings and or burnings, sexual and toiletry tortures, and general Jewish suffering and torment. I was thinking about that when they come out with this torture by the CIA using this rectal feeding thing. That's very Jewish. The myths tell us more, and you know, it's all the movies. They couldn't wait to get all kinds of things about the toilet and so forth. And Jewish humor is a lot of toilet humor. And now you've seen it creep into the movies a lot, where they show a man going into the bathroom and peeing. Now that don't seem like much to you or me, but still, why do we need to see a man peeing? Or I've seen even now women sitting on the pot in movies. Well, what's that got to do with the goddamn story? The myth tells us more about the tellers than about the subject characters, for many of these tales are totally and partly fictitious. They do not stand up to scientific examination. Let us start at the beginning of the alleged plot by the Persian Prime Minister Haman to exterminate the Jewish population. Every year, modern Jews still celebrate Haman's execution in a festival known as Purim, which involves eating pies cooked in the form of human ears. The legend tells us that Haman's plot was foiled when the king Abasura took a Jewish wife, Esther, in place of his current queen, Vashti. Esther was advised by her cousin, Mordecai, of the Haman's plot to kill Persia's entire Jewish population. And so she prevailed upon her husband, King, to execute Haman and his 10 sons and some tens of thousands of his followers. However, we read in the Encyclopedia Judaica under Purim. Now remember, they celebrate this every year, and a hell of a lot of the Persian people were white. There's still a lot of Iranians over there that are white. I've seen pictures of a lot of people coming out of Iran, and there's a hell of a lot of them are as white as any European, or any white European. You got to say that now because Europe's quickly becoming non-white also. The chronological difficulties, such as the identity of King Ahasuerus and the absence of any reference in Persian sources to a king having a Jewish consort, the striking resemblance between the names Mordecai and Esther to the Babylonian gods Marduk and Ishtar, the lack of any reference to Purim in the Jewish literature before the 1st century B.C., the language of the Book of Esther, which suggests a later date, all of these have moved the critics to look elsewhere than the account in Esther for the true origins of the festival. I get it. This festival celebrates genocide. You know, they usually accuse their enemies of what they're doing, and that's what they did to the Persians. The Iranians are, you know, was Persian, they're Persian. So no wonder they should hate the Jews. Various conjectures have been made, but the problem still awaits its solution. See, the Jews in Israel want to do the same thing that happened in this Purim with the Persians. They want to annihilate the Iranians, claiming the Iranians want to annihilate them. What goes around comes around. Esther, Ishtar, was a Jewish fertility goddess to whom firstborn Jewish children were sacrificed by their own parents. She was part of a pantheon of gods, including Moloch, the fire god, in whose fiery Auschwitzian statue more Jewish babies were burned alive. In numerous biblical Old Testament passages, we find heated debate and condemnation of this practice. Nowadays, Jewish parents do not physically sacrifice their children, well, except to drugs and Hollywood and everything else, to an altar of Jewish theology. Modern Jewish parents just inculcate sufficient guilt, anxiety, and worry into their offspring that the destruction of their psychological self-esteem is a much more punitive and therefore valuable offering. And you notice how that happens? The sons and daughters of these Jews, a hell of a lot of them that are powerful Jews or Hollywood Jews, they destroy themselves with drugs and everything else. Isn't this sort of the adult Jews reenacting that method? Only they were more honest in the old days. They just threw the kid in the fire. Jewish Talmudic literature offers all sorts of outlandish claims for Jewish casualties in the various Jewish revolts against the Roman rule. The revolt of 115 to 117 A.D. started in Libya and spread along the coast to Egypt and then to Cyprus. However, in most places, the Jews did not attack the Roman administrators or soldiers. They attacked the Greek and Roman civilians. Hundreds of thousands were massacred in response. The Roman army started killing Jews. And the Talmud tells us that in Alexandria, the casualty toll was 60 myriads. On 60 myriads, this would appear to be a total of 1,200,000. A rather remarkable figure, since Alexandria only had a total Gentile and Jewish population of some 500,000. The next Jewish revolt was 132 to 135 AD under the self-proclaimed Messiah Bar Kokhba. According to the Talmud, the revolt ended in the Romans laying siege to Bar Kokhba's fortress at Bethar near Jerusalem. Now you notice, up until then, they had allowed this guy to have this big fortress right there near Jerusalem. I mean, you know, if the Romans were so badass, why would they let him even build the son of a bitch? We're told that Bar Kokhba was so tough that he would kick catapulted Roman rocks back at them with his knee. That's, you know, it's like when the Jews created Superman in the early part of World War II. That was a Jewish creation, Superman, to fight the Nazis. It was a propaganda thing, and it continues today. They make all these movies, but that's what happened in the beginning. The Romans find, and also this Wonder Woman, that was anti-German propaganda too. The Romans finally captured the fortress in revenge, killed 4 billion, or as some say, 40 million Jews. In order to reassure us of the authenticity of these figures, the Talmud tells us that a tidal wave of Jewish blood carrying large boulders with it stained the sea for a distance of 4 miles out. The Jewish schoolchildren in Bethar, all 64 million, or as some say 150,000, were rolled up individually in their parchment scrolls and burned alive. Slain Jews were used as fence posts, and blood left over the tidal wave was used to fertilize Roman vineyards for the next 7 years. Needless to say, the Roman literature of the time does not even mention any massacre at Bethar. Credulity prevents us from accepting the Talmudic massacre allegations and their death toll, but we do detect a certain amount of synchronicity between these ancient yarns and the modern Nazi Holocaust allegations. As regards the Spanish Inquisition, we have already seen how the chief inquisitor and burner of Jews at the stake, Fray Thomas Torquemada, was himself a Jew whose father had feigned conversion to Christianity. Torquemada enrolled the assistance of pious pamphleteer Fray Alonso de Espina in his rabble-rousing activities against the Protestants, Jews, and other non-Catholics. Espina, besides being a flaming homosexual, was yet another Marrano, or Jewish pretend convert. Torquemada's successor, Fray Diego de Deza, was also a Christianized Jew. So here again, the Jews can hardly complain about Spanish Holocaust when it was in fact other Jews who were doing the persecuting and Jew burning. If anyone has a complaint, it is surely the Protestants, who were tortured and murdered both by Catholics and the Jews pretending to be Catholics. Some Jews have argued that the recitation of the Kol Nidre, or the breaking of all vows on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, was necessitated by Jews being forced to adopt Christianity during this period. But of course, Kol Nidre was in regular use long before. Before the Nazi monster came on the scene, the main character in the Jewish pantheon of demons was the Tsar and his regular pogroms against the innocent Jews. However, try as one may, there is no academic authentication that such programs ever took place. In fact, Western diplomats who investigated such allegations at the time found that the massacre stories were a pack of lies. Oxford University historian Goldwin Smith found that British consuls visiting the sites of alleged programs and found that nothing of the sort had taken place. What had happened was that the Russian workers had rioted against Jewish moneylenders and Tsarist troops were called in to quell the Russians, which they did. Various British diplomats in Russia at the time fully acknowledged that the Jews were resented by the workers and peasants, not because of their creed, but because of their loan sharking and sharp business practices. American writers also noted that Jewish predilection for usury in Russia. Mark Twain had various scathing remarks to make. So too did Portney Bigelow, who wrote for Harper's. The Russian intellectuals also held that rampant Jewish capitalism was solely responsible for anti-Jewish feeling. Alexander Pushkin included several unattractive Jewish usurers in his works, as did the lesser-known Nikolai Gogol and Dmitry Ryshenkov, a Russian authoress living in America. Zenaide Rogozin attempted to present correct perspective on the program tales in the prestigious Century Magazine, April 1882. In a hard-to-find work, Diary of a Writer, the famed Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky wrote that the Jews are draining the soil of Russia. Of course, we cannot leave a survey of Jewish persecution in Tsarist Russia without mentioning the case for our dear friend Lev Ivanovich Trotsky, or Bronstein to use his correct name. In his autobiography, My Life, he tells us that his father's estate, the workers received no shelter, no meat, and but 10 rubles a month for heavy labor. When they started to deteriorate physically, his father would give them some watermelons or a half sack of dried fish, and they would go back to work again, often singing. In the book Trotsky by Francis Whiteham and David King, we learn that Trotsky was so persecuted that he was sent off to a Tony prep school in the Russian resort of Odessa, plunging into the largely Jewish radical chic fraternity life. Trotsky and company quickly set about hatching plots to redirect all the peasant resentment against Jewish capitalists into peasant resentment against the Tsar. When they finally succeeded in having the Tsar deposed by popular unrest in the spring of 1917, who should be waiting in the wings but Trotsky and his crowd of Jewish intellectuals? Several months later, the popular democratic government was overthrown by a tiny bunch of Jewish agitators, mostly from Brooklyn, and the Jewish power was finally in total control of the reins of power. Now they could set about really ripping off the Russian workers, since there was no czar to apply a modicum of regulation. Deals were struck with wealthy Jewish capitalists in the West, such as Arm & Hammer, whereby Russian minerals and Russian labor would be ruthlessly exploited for the mutual benefit of the Jewish capitalists in the West and the Jewish state capitalists in the Soviet Union. Now, you see, I've been talking about that never was communism in Russia. I've been saying it was state capitalism for at least 30 years. I don't know whether David got it from me. We had quite a bit of contact for a while, or whether I got it from him. What greater profit base could there be in than the country where the poor labor force was captive of the government? The always upward, socially mobile Jewish landlords and loan sharks merely exchanged their snazzy civilian clothes for commissars' uniforms. The surviving of Holocaust has become something of a Jewish tradition. There is no greater survival industry than that related to the 1933-45 period, when 6 million Jews are supposed to have been done to death by the Nazi government of Germany. Again, these claims have been scrupulously examined by academics such as Dr. Butz of the Northwestern University of Chicago and Dr. Robert Forzon of the University of Lyon, and have been found to be unsupported. The California-based Institute for Historical Review published many books and a quarterly journal of historical review, which debunked such outlandish claims. Naturally, the IHR is a subject of much Jewish and Jewish-inspired opprobrium, as were those who expressed the slightest skepticism about early Jewish Holocaust claims. In this Holocaust to end all Holocausts, the same features are evident as before. The similarity of gas chambers and gas ovens to Moloch's fiery statue and to burning of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is uncanny. The exaggeration of casualty figures beyond the demographic possibilities is the same with the 6 million as with Bar Kokhba's 64 million. The heavy lacing of the narratives with sexual and toiletry torments is synchronistic. We also find many references to rats and dogs eating Jewish flesh, which bring to mind the biblical accounts of the street dogs licking up the blood of Jezebel. Let us examine a few of such narratives. The New York Times of 4 June 1974 reported on a Holocaust symposium held at the curious locale of St. John's Catholic Church in Manhattan. The reporter Israel Schenker recounted the entire rap sheet of Nazi crimes described in the symposium by survivors and by experts. The corpses of Jews were trundled to the ovens in wheelbarrows, he tells us. No water was available to prisoners. All had to drink mud. Grandparents held hands with their children while going to the ovens. Quote, hateful police dogs ate pieces of flesh alive, and rats, too, ate up the cheeks of the bodies. Mud is often cited in psychoanalysis as a symbol of excrement. Walking into a horizontal crematory furnace is not physically possible, of course. The narrator is drawing on the biblical imagery outlined earlier. The dogs and rats eating one's face is more likely the symptom of a deep neurosis than it is of empirical reality. One woman recounted, quote, then they sent us to Birkenau into the mud where there was fleas and dirt. We had no water at all. We drank mud. I had malaria. I had typhus. I had everything. But it happened that my heart kept on beating in spite of it. You don't manage to survive it just Auschwitz at the same time as it happens. My brother died in the camp. My mother was sent to Auschwitz at the same time. I saw this big fire, and I knew my mother's body was burning, and I was grateful that she should not have to see me burning in front of her or know that I saw her burning in the front of me. Professor Irving Greenberg of the City University in New York also spoke about burning, but in more theological sense. He felt that the Jews must philosophically learn to expect periods of belief interspersed with times when flames and smoke of their burning children blot out our faith, though it flickers again. The symptom of the regeneration of Jewish life through the burning or other sacrificing of Jewish children is one that we have already encountered in our examination of ancient Jewish sacrificial offerings to the fertility gods Ishtar and the fire god Moloch. We also recall that when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were tossed into the fiery furnace by an enemy king, he was promptly astounded to discover not just the three Israelites walking around in the flames, but a fourth figure, the Jewish Son of God, in there with them. We have seen the symbol recycled in the Talmudic accounts of Jewish children being burnt in their own Torah scrolls by the Romans. Almost every day when one picks up a newspaper, one reads survivors' accounts of the Holocaust, which includes such Talmudic symbolism. In the University of Tulsa Collegian, dated 11 February 1982, we read a lecture by Jack Glosser, yet another survivor of Auschwitz, who says, quote, he will never forget his work on the crew that was responsible for burying babies alive. It was not only the most inhumane thing ever done by this man who says, I probably couldn't kill a chicken if I had to. It also marked the only time he viewed a Nazi act with compassion. There was a Nazi sergeant guarding us as we buried live babies, Gloser said in his Polish-accented English. All of a sudden, he pulled a grenade from his belt and tossed it into the ditch. Then a superior officer walked by and told him that the next time he did something like that, disciplinary actions would be taken. I had a cousin who had a three-month-old daughter on the train. We took to Auschwitz, Gloser remembers. When we arrived at Auschwitz, the child was grabbed by a Nazi soldier and thrown on top of a pile of burning babies. Other parts of the Talmud are recalled when we study various descriptions of excremental assault, a survey which appears in the Terence Desprez thesis, The Survivor. Everybody in the block had typhus. It came to Bergen-Belsen in its most violent, most painful, deadliest form. The diarrhea caused by it became uncontrollable. It flooded the bottom of the cages, dripping through the cracks into the faces of the women lying in the cages below, and mixed with blood, pus, urine, formed a slimy, fetid mud on the floor of the barracks. Wow. So this is what they teach. They go around making these speeches in the schools and in the, in the schools and the churches. I mean, they tell this stuff over and over again. Here we go with mud again, about the only bodily emission that does not get to look in it is semen, a vat of which Jesus was boiled in, according to the Talmud. The wicked Nazis even tormented their captives by providing only one latrine for 30,000 to 32,000 women. This inadequacy yet again causes the Jews to foul each other. For, quote, we stood in line to get into this tiny building, knee-deep in human excrement, as we all suffered from dysentery. We could rarely wait until our turn comes and soiled our ragged clothes, which never came off our bodies. Even the luckier inmates who worked in the camp hospital had to step into human excrement, into urine soaked with blood, into the stools of patients suffering from highly contagious diseases. And some of the patients died before they ever reached the gas chambers. Many of them were covered all over with excrement, for there is no sanitary facilities. You see how much the Jews deal in excrement all the time? Having just one latrine, you know, that was what Freud dealt with all the time. It was potty stuff. That was one of his big things. Having just one latrine for all those 30,000 prisoners apparently caused the inmates to resort to unconventional toilets. Many of the women with diarrhea relieved themselves into soup bowls or the pans for coffee. Then they hid the utensils under the mattress to avoid the punishment threatening them for doing so. 25 strokes on the bare knuckles or kneeling all night long on sharp gravel, holding up bricks. These punishments often ended in the death of the guilty. Desprez scoffs at the attempts by the Jewish psychoanalysts to describe the camp experience as a reversion to infantile and anal fixated levels. He explains that in a deprived environment, it is only normal to focus totally on food and excretion. He points out that infants are not forced to wet or soil themselves, whereas prisoners had no other choice. If they attempted to go to the proper laboratory, they would be attacked by guard dogs and assaulted by guards. He goes on to describe various depraved tortures that the guards would inflict. Prisoners would be forced to urinate into each other's mouths. Soup bowls would be tossed into latrines. At Buchenwald, 10 prisoners suffocated in excrement pits in October 1937 alone. Unfortunately, none of these allegations stands up to scientific scrutiny. At Auschwitz today, one can still see the remarkable recreation facilities provided for prisoners, including a swimming pool, a soccer field, a sports stadium, a volleyball court, and a theater. Hygiene was very strictly regulated, with all the incoming internees being processed through delousing facility that involved the fumigation of their clothes in fumigation closets, hence the so-called gas chambers. At various sites, British POWs were used to assist in the delousing processes. A report by one of the POWs appeared in the Journal of the Royal Army Medical Corps in September 46. It is quite true that later in the war there was serious outbreaks of typhus on many of the camps. This was due to the breakdown of the delousing processes and the general chaos caused by the Allied bombing campaigns. Evacuees were coming in from the east where typhus was endemic. Thousands of Germans, including camp staff, died of this disease. It was not something the Germans would encourage through inadequate hygiene. On the contrary, it is something that they would rigorously try to stamp out. Posters in German and Polish were posted everywhere advising of the fatal dangers of louse infestation. One of the most telling cases of the survival fantasy is that of Kitty Hart, whose experiences as an inmate were described in the Yorkshire television program Kitty, Return to Auschwitz, shown on British television in November 79, and on American PBS stations a year later. The TV dialogue with her son at the remains of Auschwitz went like this, quote, Kitty, she says, if you didn't have your bowl, you didn't have your soup. If you didn't have your bowl, you didn't have your toilet, because your bowl was your toilet. You understand? The son says, how did you wash the bowl out? Kitty, you didn't. Son, before you ate? Kitty, I mean you didn't. You didn't. You didn't wash it out. That was your life. Your bowl. My bowl. It was red. Later, now I know, David, you're seeing grass, but I don't see any grass. I see mud, a sea of mud, and believe me, if there was one blade, one blade of grass, you know what would have happened. You'd have eaten it. Then just a little while later, we find Kitty lying on a complete lawn of grass, this time seemingly resisting the impulse to start grazing. It was a glorious summer, so during the day I sat here on the lawn sunbathing. We were laughing and joking. I was lying here and I was watching the crematory over there. You saw the SS men and the extermination squad that did the actual killing, you know, the actual gassing. So somewhere there was a ladder. You could see it when you were lying here. And this SS man climbed up the ladder with a tin of gas, which he had in his hand, and through the skylight, he just dropped it in, this tin, and then he came down and went, and off he went. And then a few seconds later, you heard a sort of muffled sound, and those were the people actually suffocating. And then, all of a sudden, it was quite clear then, soon after that, you lay here, and you could actually see smoke coming out of the chimney. And those were the very people that were burning. And do you think that I could believe that there were people actually burning in there? I couldn't believe it. Can you believe it? No. But people were burning there, and you could hear them screaming. Well, you still couldn't believe it. People were being sent in one end, and they were ashes at the other end. 10 minutes later. Of course, you know it takes an average, in the old days, about 4-5 hours to cremate a body. Kitty also reveals that she was one of those odd folks in Auschwitz who washed in her own urine. Throughout the film, she continually returns to urine, mud, bread. She is either bathing in urine, eating from her excrement-encrusted bowl, swimming in a sea of mud, eating mud, or eating mouthfuls of bread. We know right away that something is wrong. Asphyxiated, stone-dead people do not scream when they are cremated. Bodies cannot be reduced to ashes in 10 minutes. A more reasonable time would be 2 to 3 hours. No, it's longer than that. And that's only with modern crematorium. And there is just too many self-contradictions in her story to make it the slightest bit plausible. If she would munch on one blade of grass in a sea of mud, how come she could sunbathe on an entire lawn? Kitty is sorely in need of some good counseling to determine the underlying causes of her fixations on anal functions. Perhaps her childhood toilet training was too strict, and she subconsciously feels that opening her bowels without permission will lead to dire punishment like asphyxiation and burning. Another survivor whose attic is full of junk is one Fania Fenelon, the subject of an American TV documentary, Playing for the Time. The TV production caused a storm of controversy because the anti-Zionist actress Vanessa Redgrave was cast in the lead role. In the case of Miss Fenelon's book of the same title, we are only on page one of her narrative before she tells us that, quote, a trick I'd found to cool myself was to wash my own urine. Keeping myself clean was essential to me, and there was nothing unclean about urine. I could drink it if I was thirsty, and I had done so. Well, let's see here. That's about it for today. I thought we'd get through the whole thing today, but we didn't. So I think we can finish this tomorrow. Yeah, I think we can finish it tomorrow, but it'll probably be Wednesday that we get into the juicy part of the Hitler's youth and so forth. See, one thing I'm going to tease you with, if the extermination of 6 million is fake, then you got to think, well, if most of it didn't happen, then why does Hitler get the blame for it, for something that didn't happen? A lot of people died in the moving of Jews across Europe, ostensibly with the agreement with the Zionists to get them across to Palestine. But I think they have to clutter and screw up their narrative by creating this vast supposed genocide in the middle of it. So you're not tempted to say, well, Hitler was honestly trying to get the Jews out of Germany and get them over to Palestine. Now, we do know that he made the deal with the Zionists. They even struck a medal for it. And we also know that the SS and the rabbis down there in, where was it? Anyhow, they were making a deal for the ships to take the Jews over to Palestine. And they appealed to rich Jews in New York and the United States to fund it. And they tried to go to Franklin D. Roosevelt, and he refused because they needed the ships for the war effort. Well, that's a cheap out, because there was all kinds of ships available. And so when you take the so-called myth of genocide out, well, we're going to leave you hanging on that one, because we're going to be bringing a lot of other stuff out here as the days go on. Something you can either get pissed off at and call Tom Metzger a raving idiot and probably a Jew or communist or something. To those people, well, you can have your opinion. I've been forming mine now for 40 years, and I'm coming down to the wire on it. I think I'm going to have it all figured out before I kick the bucket, hopefully. 14-5, and watch out for Sneak and Peek, because when I say don't let them in without a warrant, they don't have to have a warrant, or at least they don't have a legitimate Anglo-Saxon warrant to come into your house when you're not there and spend 2 or 3 hours going through everything in your house and leave. Evidently, they get these so-called warrants through the FISA courts. So you can keep them out while you're there, but you can't keep them out when you're not there. What a sick bunch of crap. 14.5. Shut up. The biggest thing that's fed this type situation, warrantless searches, is the drug thing. And, of course, it's always been in the best interest of the government to have this plague of narcotics. Yeah, they love it. They make a lot of money off of it, and they can build more jails, more prisons, and everything else. So just the opposite of being threatened by the drug industry, the people in power and government and law enforcement love it. And, of course, that leads to all kinds of other what we would call unconstitutional, even though I don't have any faith in the Constitution. So bye-bye.